Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, we'll re-air some of our favorite recent conversations for Labor Day.
I think my primary job is to be honest, you know, to be really, really, really honest and to prepare that boy to go out in the world and be armed to defend himself.
That's the Atlantic magazine writer Ta-Nehisi Coates. We'll hear him reflect more on the letters he wrote to his teenage son, which he published in a now best-selling book called Between the World and Me. Plus, we'll hear why some conflicts at work can be rooted in misunderstandings between men and women and how to address them, why a simple walk through nature can have a positive effect on your mental health. And we'll take a close look at the complicated, sometimes romantic relationships between inmates and prison guards. But first, for Labor Day, a new report from urbanist Richard Florida and his colleagues at NYU. It describes New York City's astounding economic resiliency after two hurricanes, two financial crises, and one world-altering terrorist attack. But as we all know, these epic events have left us with a different kind of inequality and class structure than the city had seen before. So we will hear now how Richard Florida and company describe the city's simultaneous phenomenal success and daunting new class divide. He teaches at NYU and the University of Toronto and joins us with Stephen Pedigo, Director of Creative Cities and Civic Innovation at the NYU School of Professional Studies. So, Richard Florida, welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be back, Brian.
And Professor Pedigo, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having us.
So, Richard, you're famous for being the great optimist about cities that grow their creative class, but you write that even you were surprised by the comeback of New York since 2007. How so?
So on the one hand, it's optimism on steroids. You know, and we've talked about this. During the Great Recession, people said New York was finished. It would be eclipsed either by London, but more likely a new startup Asian city. And as an economic crisis decimated our financial markets, so too would go New York. And what we found is nothing seems to take New York out, as you said in that great intro. Hit with body blows from natural disasters to economic crises to terrorist attacks, all in a quite short span of time, a decade and a half. New York is back and its economy is stronger than ever, but then optimism confounded. As New York has come back, I think few would have anticipated that we would have no longer face an urban crisis so much a failure, right, the old 1970s fiscal crisis, but a new urban crisis of tremendous success and these gaping divides. And I think in the report, you know, Stephen and our colleagues, Rosemary Scanlon, Hugh Kelly, and others, we dug deep and found when we looked outside of, within Manhattan, but outside of Manhattan to the other boroughs, you could see flourishing pieces of an economy and then a much larger part of the city that's unfortunately not keeping pace.
And you see an ongoing evolution from a finance-driven economy to a full-blown creative economy, as you call it. Richard, what is a full-blown creative economy?
Well, I think this has been going on for 20 or 30 years, and it's kind of that the crisis made this evident. You know, that's the crisis kind of cleared away all the clouds. And, you know, we used to think of New York's economy as primarily finance or fire, finance, insurance, and real estate. What we've seen, and Stephen did the analysis, this remarkable analysis he did with industrial and occupational data, that it's really arts, media, the digital sector, technology startups that have become kind of the dominant economic cluster, if you will, the most competitively advantaged. So New York still remains the world's greatest finance center. Perhaps only London can challenge it. But it also has become the world's leading media, you know, and increasingly music and entertainment center, of course, vying with L.A. and London, who are also quite competitive there. So I think we've seen the economy diversify even further than it had and become much more of a knowledge-based or creative economy.
And I think we should say, Stephen, that your definition of creative class includes things like science and engineering and software development, not just arts and culture.
That's right. I mean, when you think about the creative class, it's people that get sort of paid. Well, we like to say just get paid to think for a living, right? People that are working with their minds. And so that includes technologists, includes people in arts and culture, professional, and then education, right? These folks that are working in places like NYU and Columbia, like myself. So it is folks that get paid to think for a living. And I think what's actually interesting about the report is that it is surprising to look at the creative class in Manhattan. We're not surprised that this is arts and creative center. But some of the things that we did is we actually looked at all of the boroughs. And when you look at places like Brooklyn and Queens and the Bronx, there is actually creative centers that are emerging there. So, for instance, in the Bronx, you see large concentrations of folks who are working in education and healthcare. If you look at Brooklyn, you see the bubbling of an emerging technology healthcare scene, the same thing that's happening in Queens, right?
Is that considered creative class, though? Because I thought that's sort of the mass. Certainly teachers are professionals. There's a lot of healthcare professionals, but healthcare is also an engine for service economy jobs now. So is that considered creative class by your definition?
We would absolutely include the folks that are doctors and nurses, therapists, et cetera. So some of the higher elevated levels of education required in healthcare, bioscience, et cetera. So some of those folks absolutely would be included part of the study. As we looked at those.
And I think for folks listening in, the big thing for us, in addition to all of that, is the fact that New York has become the world's second most important high-tech startup scene. And our work documents that. We find $3 billion in venture capital funding flowing into the city. But also, you know, a report last week by a group that characterized startup ecosystems around the world, you know, they gauged every city around the world, put New York in number two spot behind the San Francisco Bay Area. And I think if you had asked somebody 20 years ago, would New York be a startup high-tech center that would surpass Boston or Seattle, where Microsoft, they'd have said, are you on planet Zing? And I think the fact that New York has developed this startup scene to us was quite dramatic, and it suggests that startups are increasingly drawn to more of an urban center than the kind of older suburban, you know, nerdistan, if you will, the office park that used to seem to drive technology in the future. And that, of course, Brian, puts pressure on real estate prices, office space, housing, and create some of these problems that the report also documents.
And creative class jobs, your report documents, pay better than average because you have creative class jobs at a third of New York City jobs, but more than half the total wages. And you have a chart that shows finance and healthcare may include more jobs, but New York has a big creative class advantage compared to other cities. And that's, I guess, Richard, what you were just laying out. Let's get more into the weeds about the divide. You sound in the report kind of like Mayor de Blasio when you say minimum wage to $15, massive affordable housing programs, and better mass transit, especially bus rapid transit with dedicated bus lanes, because that can be created so much faster than new subways. Are these the mainstream, are these the solutions that you're advocating in the report, Stephen?
I just want to back up one minute, yeah. Brian, and then let Stephen take those on. I think for folks listening in, it's important to point out that while the creative economy and the tech economy is sprouting up in across the city, it is massively concentrated in Manhattan. That a large, nearly a million of the 1.4 million of these good, high-paying knowledge jobs remain in Manhattan. And when you look across the outer boroughs or the other boroughs, Brooklyn has been claimed to be a rapidly up-and-coming borough, and it has some of this, but it's far, far behind Manhattan. So that's the one thing. Manhattan remains the centerpiece of this. The second thing that's even more disturbing to us is
Them's fighting words in Park Slope, by the way.
While the creative class worker, the knowledge worker, the professional worker, the tech worker is taking home a pretty good amount of money, on average, $85,000-$90,000 in Manhattan, less than that in the other boroughs. Mm-hmm. The service workers, you know, the people who prepare our food, take care of our kids, you know, take care of our homes, run our hospitality and tourism, are those healthcare assistants and aides in the hospitals, teacher assistants, and so forth. they're making 30 grand, and they're falling further behind, and they're 50% of New York City's workforce, and in the other boroughs, 52%. So I think the divide is really a divide between a knowledge economy or a professional economy that a third of New Yorkers participate in, and, you know, a terribly lagging low wage routine service economy that more than half of New Yorkers participate in, and they're unfortunately falling further and further behind. And I think in that spirit, we think something that we need to, that something needs to be done, and that Mayor de Blasio has started this, but I think we even believe it needs to go further.
And so, Stephen, you frame class in three categories today's economy before we get back to the specific solutions: creative class, service class, and working class. So what's the difference between service and working class?
Yes, so service class is exactly the type of people that Richard just described, people that maybe walk your dog, take care of your kids, work teacher's aides, et cetera. When you start to think of the working sector, those are some of the blue-collar workers, right? Folks that work in transportation tend to work in manufacturing, production, so the traditional sort of, as you would think about, blue-collar jobs. I think the interesting thing about Richard, sort of to highlight the thing that Richard's talking about in terms of the service sector, in fact, if you look at New York's economy, the fastest growing sector in New York's economy is actually the service sector, and it's growing rapidly, right? It's growing about 9%. So it is a fast-growing divide. So not only is divide present, but it's going to continue to get wider as the service sector continues to grow much faster.
So on housing, Richard, for example, when you say go further than Mayor de Blasio, he's got his 200,000 units to be created or preserved of affordable housing. You're right that he can go even further with things like land trusts. Is that worth taking some time to define?
Yeah, I think a couple things. And I just want to put this in a framework that goes a little bit beyond Mayor de Blasio. When you talk to many economists and people who study cities, they tend to believe if we just build more housing, if we just release the restrictions, we'll get more housing built. And I think what's happened in New York, and I think callers would agree, we've done that, and you know what we've gotten? More luxury housing. So that we need a variety of approaches to affordable housing, and it's not like everything's going to work. We're in a period where we have to experiment. We have to build more affordable housing. We might need to provide, and we talk about providing rental assistance. We talk about the need to include land trusts. But the other thing, and I think that's really important, we say that, and this is where we say go beyond the mayor to some degree, that just working on the housing side will be great, but it won't solve the problems. People need to be – the affordable housing crisis is not simply about building housing. We had Seth Pinsky, who worked for Mayor Bloomberg, and he framed it very nicely at our opening event. He said affordability usually means not enough income to rent or buy housing. So that's where that minimum wage comes in, and that's where upgrading these service jobs into good-paying middle-class jobs. And then finally, if we don't have the transit we need – We're constrained to living in the places that are near transit and the prices spike, so we definitely need a transit strategy to open up new places for more development and more intensive development. So I just want to say that it's all of a piece. Housing, better incomes, minimum wage, better jobs, and more transit have to go together. Any one of those things alone can't work. It needs to be all of a single piece.
Richard Florida and Stephen Pettigo from NYU. Stephen has this great title. Do I have your title right? This is a great title if I have it right. Director of Creative Cities and Civic Innovation at the NYU School of Professional Studies. Are you really a director of Creative Cities?
I try to be, yeah.
That's a great job. Alex in Battery Park City, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thanks, guys. Very interesting conversation. I agree in a lot of cases that the creative economy is obviously booming. I think you see a new even though it's attached to the central business district, Dumbo is a good example of a new neighborhood where it's been transformed into an office park type place. I was wondering what you guys think about places like Willets Point or maybe further outer borough developments for office space for new places for creative class, like you said, connected to transportation. How do you feel about that in the whole affordable housing, creative class, opportunity for work discussion?
Yeah, I just had my – so not the neighborhoods that you just mentioned, but I had a group of 15 high school students here this week doing a high school city building program, and I took them out to Queens, particularly Long Island City. And one of the things that's amazing what's happening out with the Long Island City Partnership and organizations like Coalition for Queens is that you are starting to see a sprouting of a creative economy in those parts because of the types of space that's available, this industrial sort of raw type of office space that's become really, really interesting. And it's becoming popular with creative companies because you can start to see the mix and the messiness of different types of companies come together. And as you talk to the folks in Long Island City, that seems to be the real appeal for the types of companies, and particularly creative companies, that they're attracting to that area, is that types of interesting Class B or C office space, not your A type of office space. But these types of companies are looking for flex space, place that can be interesting, big windows, the types of space that sort of we're in today, right, that's interesting and unique.
But,
and I think you start to see that.
But how far from Manhattan can this really go? I mean, he said Dumbo, which last I looked was down under the Manhattan Bridge overpass, which is to say it's 5 feet from Manhattan. Long Island City, too. Willett's Point, which he also mentioned, is, I think, in another category. And if it were to work there, then it sets a different kind of precedent, Richard.
So I think you put your finger on it, that this is massively concentrated in Manhattan in a way that helped the city or Manhattan rebound, but bodes ill for the city's future. The transit lines all come into Manhattan, and we're not talking about in this report where the creative and the professionals and the techies live. They may well live in Park Slope and other places, but to this day, most of them, the vast majority of them, work in Manhattan. That is why we need a strategy for dispersing, disaggregating, and clustering this creative economy in more of these outer places. And I think what's happening, and I think Stephen and the caller are right about this, what's happening in the natural evolution of the city is that everything clusters very tightly in parts of Lower Manhattan, Chelsea, Soho, Tribeca, and all the rest. And then as this group of professionals gets priced out or desires a different kind of lifestyle, they move to Brooklyn and further out. And then eventually, with smart strategy and the right transit strategy, you can develop nodes and clusters of activity out there. But I think this just won't happen on its own. And what we'll end up with is more and more pressure on office and residential real estate markets in Manhattan. And again, just to go back to the mayor, it's not just about affordable housing. It's about building an economy. And building an economy requires this clustered kinds of development, active strategizing to build up these places, transit connectivity, and particularly not just building the knowledge piece of this economy, upgrading those low-wage jobs so that they can become the new middle-class jobs.
Eric in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hello, Eric.
Yes, hi. I'm an independent inventor that grew up just a few miles from where the Xerox machine was invented in Astoria. And I was wondering, separating the creative ties between techies and programmers that may work for larger companies from smaller artists and independent inventors, how sustainable do you think New York is going to be, considering the fact that rents are rising for smaller, independent inventors and creative types?
Yeah, this is a central question, Stephen, and I think your report and the conversation we've been having almost frames creative class workers as the professional successes, and then the high cost of living in New York really plagues the service economy workers and the working class workers. But really, you know, we've done so many shows on how artists can't live in New York anymore, and so what's going to happen to New York as a creative hub if you can't afford to live here anymore? So how do these things exist at the same time?
Well, one of the things the report actually does is actually look at this idea of the freelance creative economy. And so, in fact, what we found in the report is actually when you look at the recession, when the recession first hit, there was obviously the boom of this freelance economy, partly with the creative economy. But as the economy has recovered, we have seen, and prices have risen, we have seen a lot of these freelance folks go back to typical creative payroll jobs. I mean, I think that the thing that becomes a challenging issue is just as the point that Richard has mentioned, as you think about this idea of a freelance free agent creative economy, The question is how do you make, how do you provide the benefits and the support to make those folks successful, right? So this idea of better affordable housing, do we have some types of housing policies around that provides, some had said control and rent, et cetera, right? So there is still this idea of needing this. But there is something to be said about some of this idea of the freelance sort of creative economy also giving life to a lot of these outer boroughs, right? As Richard says, a lot of these folks continue to get pushed out. They continue also to be the urban pioneers, right? The folks that continue to help revitalize a lot of these neighborhoods, particularly not only in New York, but also in the larger metropolitan area here, places like New York, for
instance. Neighborhoods left to revitalize in New York City by starving artists?
Well, so I would say this, a couple of things in which the data now are pretty clear. There has been a lot of heat about artists and musicians being pushed out of New York. And that is certainly true, that areas of Soho that, when I was a very young boy and a college student, were affordable for artists have become unaffordable for artists. But when you look at the data, the New York City and New York metropolitan area, along with Los Angeles, remains by far the dominant location, not just in terms of absolute numbers, in terms of any way you want to control that for population, the dominant location by far for independent artists, visual artists, fashion designers, independent musicians. So, yeah, it's hard, but no place, take Chicago, the third largest city, it lags by an enormous amount, New York and Los Angeles. And yes, there has been some migration of artists to Los Angeles. Los Angeles is actually picking up steam. But the real point that this report, and this is really important for folks listening in, the divide within the creative class or the professional class is one thing. And for every artist who gets pushed out, it's terrible. And New York loses some energy. And many of those places can find more affordable housing in other boroughs or in New Jersey. But the divide that separates this whole group from the service class is really troubling. You're talking about a divide that is large and growing, with people having to work multiple jobs and have multiple family members and commute exhausting distances. So I think I just want to put my finger, while a lot of heat is spent on artists being pushed out, and it's a very important issue, the much bigger issue New York City faces is this gasping class divide between its knowledge class and its service workers.
And so we're out of time, except to say that even the revitalization of neighborhoods by pioneering starving artists, if we want to still call them that, is a double-edged sword. Because on one hand, it improves neighborhoods. On the other hand, for the service class and working class people, they are the harbingers of gentrification, and they're going to get priced out from yet another place they're living.
Exactly. And that's why we need a comprehensive strategy that works not just on the housing side, but on the job side, the income side, the minimum wage side, and on the transit side together.
All right. Very interesting new report about the upside and the downside of the New York City economy from Richard Florida and Stephen Pettigo from NYU. Thank you both very much for sharing it with us.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you, Brian.
Coming up next, why some misunderstandings at work can be blamed on gender. Stay with us. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. It's the Brian Lehrer show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. The battle of the sexes isn't over. In fact, it's probably happening in your office right now. Though women and men are almost equally represented in the U.S. labor force, the workplace is still rife with conflicts and misunderstandings rooted in gender. Do you ever feel the work habits of the opposite sex, like the amount of questions she asks or the way he takes credit for a project, makes your office life more difficult than it has to be? Maybe there's more to your feelings than just aggrieved stereotyping. Studies show that there are differences in the work habits of men and women, which can be at odds with each other. For example, women ask more questions, gather more people's opinions, and seek collaboration with coworkers more frequently than men. Men view these preferences as signs of weakness, and women, in turn, grow annoyed by how competitively men work and how quickly and unilaterally they arrive at conclusions. Is the way you work different than someone of the opposite sex in your office? These are generalizations, but still may hold true in a large percentage of cases. Does it cause workplace problems when these things surface? We've got someone who can help. With us now is Barbara Annis, founder of the Gender Intelligence Group, a consultancy that works with executives at major firms, including American Express, BMO Financial, eBay, to create strategies to transform their work cultures into ones that are friendly to both men and women. In 2013, she co-wrote the book, Work With Me, The 8 Blind Spots Between Men and Women in Business, along with John Gray of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus fame. Welcome to WNYC, Barbara Annis.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
So your book, Work With Me, drew on more than 100,000 interviews with executives at some 60 big corporations and from workshops you ran at these companies. What did you find was the number one complaint from each sex?
Well, it was really interesting because, you know, women would say men don't listen, right? And women would say, women would say men don't listen, and men would say women ask too many questions, right? And it's just that it's not that men don't listen, but men tend to listen differently. And often women misinterpret that, right? Because men tend to not use as many words and when they're asking questions. They listen for the bottom line, and women listen for more of the details, you know, to be more thorough in their thought process. So that's one of the fundamental differences that we see.
What's the objection to asking a lot of questions? I thought that was a good thing when you're trying to solve a problem.
It really is, you know. I mean, and, you know, and especially now that we use email a lot, it can be very frustrating for men because men tend to use a one-liner, yes, do that. And women will go back and say, what about this, this, and this, right? And then, I mean, I just had literally a law firm last week. I had a woman lawyer and a male lawyer. And a woman lawyer came in and said, I think I'm being discriminated against. And I said, why? And she said, look at, and she had printed out all these emails. And her emails were very concise, detailed-oriented. And he said, sounds good to me, right? And she misinterpreted that as being dismissive or he didn't really care about the details that she was providing, right? And he was just really, he was a very transactional guy. Now, keep in mind, there's a bell curve in everything, right? So it's not that all men and all women are like this.
Right.
But there are these norms or these tendencies that we fall into. And this is a one example where she actually felt she was discriminated when she wasn't at all. And when I talked to him, he went, what? Are you kidding me?
Gee,
I was just trying to free you up to get a job done, right?
The word sounds good to me. That sounds like you're giving somebody praise and accepting their recommendations rather than discriminating against them.
Exactly. But keep in mind that she had a water torture experience of this. She had, I don't know how many, but it was a stack of 2 inches of emails, right,
mm-hmm.
that she had where she was experiencing this. So,
right.
But her ladder of inference was incorrect because she lacked gender intelligence, right? She didn't see him as who he was, and he was just wired in a very transactional way. And she was wired more in a relational way, right? So she wanted to constantly check and check in and have a huddle and so on. And he didn't need that. He trusted her to do the job. Right.
Is there a main reason that businesses call on your consultancy? Like, I don't think they call up and say, the women think the men are too pushy and the men think the women are asking too many questions. It's probably something more specific than that.
Absolutely, yeah. So there are two reasons that they tend to call us. One is, why haven't we made progress with the advancement of women at the very senior level? Right? We've had great strides at 50% in mid-management. And somehow we haven't been able to get at the very top, right? You know, so the average has been, it's anywhere between 7% and 20%,
mm-hmm.
right? The global
mm-hmm.
average is actually 20%. So depending on which industry, right? So that's one question. The second is we don't seem to be able to retain women as much as we do men. So that's another challenge that women tend to vote with their feet more than men do in certain industries. But those are the two key questions that they ask.
And before we go to some of our callers, I read another interview with you where you said the number one assumption that companies make as to why women don't advance and why women leave the office is because of a work-life balance conflict, being a mommy, but that a different story emerges from the women who have in fact left. Can you clarify that for us?
Yeah. So, you know, the key factor that women tend to leave is that they don't feel valued, right? They don't feel valued in the workplace. And this, by the way, also goes into the female client. For example, women clients, I have one client that I had for 2 years, they called and said, help us. We have 70%, this is an investment firm, 70% of women fire their financial advisor within 1 year of their spouse passing away. Why? We can't figure this out, right? And that's another piece of they didn't feel valued. They didn't feel heard, right? Now, however, women tend to say they leave because of work-life balance because it's a valid reason. It is a challenge, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a mother of 7 children. I know it's a challenge, right? Mm. I don't have work-life balance, right?
No, if you have 7 children, you have no balance.
No, but zero, yeah.
But you have this career.
Yes, I have this career, and I'm able to do it, and I don't have work-life balance, but I do have work-life harmony. So I'm able to, you know, I'm the CEO, so I'm able to flex things and, you know, be with my children when I need to, and also meet deadlines when I need to. So it has more of a harmony into it in terms of its flexibility.
William in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call, Brian. I have a question. It's kind of a question and a statement at the same time. To the lady, why is it that women? Oh, I feel that women they bring their issues to work. Why don't they distinguish between home and business? When a woman comes to work, they want their boss to treat them as they wish their husband treat them. So much attention and attention to detail. I mean, if your boss is short on sentences, he writes short emails. They want to him to explain the way the husband would explain. So in short, I'm saying, why don't women distinguish that this is business, this is work, and then my feelings, my emotions, I leave them at the door.
Oh, boy. You got a 2-year assignment just from that phone call, Barbara.
All right, a workshop. We'll get William in a workshop. Yeah. Let me answer it. So there are some interesting hardwiring differences between men and women. Men can kind of really separate personal life from business life. It's very easy, you know, and men can tune out. Even, I don't know how many times you've heard women say, what are you thinking? And men say, nothing. Men can actually think about nothing, right? So when men are relaxing, they actually can space out, and boys as well, right? So there's that separation that in the hardwiring of men and women, it's much more connected, right? It's all connected, intertwined, right? So the impact of that, it's called the consequential thinking. So now the question is, should women separate or should they bring their whole selves to work? I think it would be the latter rather than the earlier. I mean, I think we've tried. I mean, I remember I was a salesperson at Sony when I first started my career. I was the only woman out of 600 sales guys, right? Mm. And I took on, because I had to, a very guy way of thinking, very male way of thinking, right? And I didn't have pictures of my children on my desk or anything like that. That's not the kind of life we want today, I don't think. I don't know what you think.
William? Maybe that's a start. Thank you for calling. I want to read some stats from your book, and I'd love if you could illustrate one or two of these figures with some real-life examples you've come across. You say 82% of women feel some form of exclusion, whether in business, social events, casual meetings, conversations, or in getting feedback. Some 92% of men don't believe they're excluding women. Another stat, 79% of men feel they have to be careful and indirect when giving women critical feedback. 82% of women say they want to get direct feedback from men. Yeah. So is there a walking on eggshells issue in that one, for example?
Yep. So let's go with the first one. So this, the concept of being excluded. So women have this experience that the real meeting after the meeting is they're not invited into, or the topic of conversation, or they'll walk into a meeting that, and the topic has already started, and men will change the conversation as they walk in, right? Or it's the golf, or it's the beer, going for a beer kind of thing. And it still exists today. And it's not, you know, intended. And, of course, men look at their intentions and say, of course I don't want to exclude women, you know. That's not my intention at all, right? I don't even think about doing that, right? But men kind of tend to be comfortable with men, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? We just need to increase men's comfort zone, right, so they can include more women, you know, to go for a beer, etc. The other thing that men tend to do is they'll ask, let's say, Sarah once, do you want to go for a beer? And she'll go, no, thanks, I've got other things to do. And then they'll say, okay, I asked her once, so I'm not going to ask her again. That's, you know, kind of thing. So that's a common assumption in that one. In the carefulness, it's very interesting because men feel that they can be very direct with men. it's not a problem. You know, I can say, why don't you fix these three things? Do it, right? And with women, they feel they have to couch it, be more careful. How was your day? You know, kind of, you know. And women really want the direct. You know, give me it so I can learn and grow. Right, so that's something we really need to create a breakthrough around, and it happens in every industry around the world.
So on that one, do you have a why? If women want the directness, why do men feel they need to be less direct with the women colleagues than the men colleagues?
Because women tend to react differently to feedback, right? Women tend to personalize it more, and that's okay, right? What did I do? How could I have done it better? And et cetera. And men don't know how to deal with that. And there might be one situation once, not that many women do it anymore at all, but there might be one situation where they experience women getting emotional and having tears, right? And if that happens once, they go, oh, I'm never going to go there again, kind of thing, right? So it's really about just increasing your comfort zone in that and giving the direct feedback. I mean, women value that so much rather than hearing it third hand, you know? You know, Hans thinks this, or he said this, right? Let me give you a very specific example, because this is on Wall Street. So I was on Wall Street, and I was talking to one of the senior executives there, and he said, you know, I have 12 direct reports, 2 women, and they're fantastic women, amazing women. Now, if one of them could only work on this one thing, they would be even more, even better. And I asked him, have you told her? And he said, I don't even know where to go with that. Like, I don't even know where to go with that. I said, okay, you got Bob with a different issue. Have you told him? And he said, oh, yeah, I've told him. He's fixed it. It's done, right? So here's this woman who's fantastic, and there's one thing that she needs to, that everybody knows about, right? So that's where we need to create a breakthrough in that, in giving women feedback. And when women get it, they value it so much. You know, as long as it's framed right, you need to be gender intelligent in how you give that feedback as well, right?
Barbara Annis from the Gender Intelligence Group, a workplace gender consultant, and Nicole in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Nicole.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Uh-huh. I was wondering if the guest had any reaction or any feedback on policies, such as maternity leave policies, and how they put such a tremendous burden on the woman. And so many of these policies in workplaces, they don't allow for women to take off if you have a sick child. They expect you to come back to work within 8 or 12 weeks of having a baby. And these types of things end up oftentimes really hurting women in terms of their performance or in terms of their ability to move up the ladder. And I'm wondering if your guest has any response to that.
Yeah. I mean, yes. Do we need to create more enlightened policies? Absolutely. And I think there are organizations who have really done that. There are more that needs to do that. The 8 to 12 weeks, it's incredible. If you look around the world, I mean, you can hear an accent. I'm Danish, you know. You get 2 years, you know, 2 years of maternity leave. Now, we pay a lot more taxes, I admit, right? In Canada, it's 1 year, right? The 8 to 12 weeks is rather daunting. I mean, I was just talking to a woman who worked at one of the investment firms in New York, and she just got back. She's 12 weeks in. She got back, and she's traveling with her baby through the heat, you know, to get her to daycare and then to get to the firm. And it's a shock to her system and probably the baby system too. So it's something we need to be much more innovative. But what's interesting about it is that there's research around financial service firms that 86% of women who go on maternity leave don't return to their original employer, although 92% return to work, but they don't return to their original employer. And it is in the experience of leaving, of being pregnant, what the policies are. Do I have a guarantee that I'm going to come back to the original job or a similar type of job, right? All of those things. Am I being viewed as lesser than after having children or a child, kind of thing, right? So all of those things need to be addressed, absolutely.
You know, we're getting a few phone calls, so let me take one of them, questioning the whole premise of the 8 blind spots between men and women in business as, like, generalizing too much. Peter in Manhattan, is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, the conversation frustrates me a little bit because it's sort of led into by saying that these are our generalizations, but then the rest of the conversation, we're talking about these things as if it's obvious from them that they're derived of gender interaction when, you know, I have no qualms with the last statement that was made. I absolutely think that it's a burden on women, the way that we structure our maternity leave system. And I especially think there's a lot of problems in the workplace with how policy relates to problems that women have and not enough acknowledgement of it. My issue is just that a lot of these interpersonal struggles seem like they're more psychological or just, you know, the generalizations that are being made don't work in both directions. So, like, just really just for anyone to stand up here and say that women want this, men feel this, you're not going to derive any rational sort of understanding out of that because the people are just way too individual for that to apply in this broad of a context.
Peter, I'm going to leave it there and get an answer to exactly that question that you just asked. So, Barbara Annis, what would you say?
Well, the interesting thing about that is perceptions become reality, right? So when we're standing, and we need to deal with that, right? Otherwise, it just continues and perpetuates, right? And this is a perceptional analysis of 240,000 men and women around the world, and the consistency is there. So it needs to be addressed. And the only way to address it is to stand in both men and women's shoes and honor their perception, and then address it and resolve it.
Do
right?
women ever push back on you, like a feminist argument that...
Sure.
If you're coming at the workplace with an innate differences model, that's going to wind up disadvantaging women in the long run rather than assuming that people are basically the same and need to be treated as individuals.
Yeah. I mean, we've had that argument, right? Now, the neuroscience is so incredible today in terms of the type of research that has been done all over the world, 1 million people, 30 countries, all continents, around brain-based differences. And there's more and more that I haven't even seen that I know is from in front of my desk in my inbox. Mm. And children, you know, there are gender differences in how boys and girls learn. And if we assume that we're all based on sameness because we say individualistic, we're creating a form of enlightened denial. I mean, I was talking to a CEO in Sweden, very, very famous technology company.
That's a fascinating phrase there, enlightened denial.
Yep. And he said in Sweden, in Scandinavia, we've created a form of enlightened denial. My mother said, don't differentiate. You know, we're all individuals, right? And I saw all these gender differences working with women, and I didn't know what to do with them, and so I just didn't do anything, right? I was just politically correct about it, right? So egalitarian mindset has become this equality mindset, which has equated to sameness. And the problem with that is these gender differences stubbornly merge like dandelions on a chemically treated lawn when you ask both men and women, what is your perception? So the key is just to honor their reality and then resolve it from there. And understand there's a bell curve here. You know, there's a huge spectrum, right, a bell curve that we need to also be aware of.
Barbara Annis, founder of the Gender Intelligence Group, a consultancy that works with executives at major firms. Thank you very much. You've started a lot of conversation, that's for sure, on our social media feeds and I guess in a lot of places. So thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up after the news, the Atlantic writer who is now so acclaimed, Ta-Nehisi Coates, his new book, Between the World and Me, is made up of letters to his 14-year-old son about the persistence of structural racism and the challenges that his son's generation will face. That's coming up next, the very moving and insightful Ta-Nehisi Coates, as we continue here on The Brian Lehrer Show with some of our recent favorites for Labor Day. But first, here's the latest news, live right now from the WNYC newsroom. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer Show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the Atlantic Magazine's Ta-Nehisi Coates has written maybe the perfect book for this summer when we're taking stock 1 year after the deaths of Eric Garner and Michael Brown. Between the World and Me is a short book, about 175 pages, written as letters to Ta-Nehisi's 16-year-old son. It frames the structural persistence of racism as the central challenge for kids coming up today in the generation after the dream of Martin Luther King and after the hope of Barack Obama. The operative word for Coates is struggle, and without any great faith that the arc of history necessarily bends toward justice. Always good to have Ta-Nehisi Coates on the program. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
I read most of the book over the weekend. Fascinating, amazing, powerful. There are so many places I could start, but I want to start with the concept of fear, because I think there's a stereotype of black rage and white fear. But you write about black fear, like your father beating you with a belt when you were a kid, being out of fear. Why would that have been out of fear?
Well, African Americans across multiple vectors, in general, subject to more violence than virtually any other group in this country. And what I mean by multiple vectors is, okay, so there's the neighborhood, for instance, that I grew up in West Baltimore, where the preservation and the protection of my body was constant. Whenever I was walking out in the street, whenever I was going to school, whenever I was going to visit a friend. And then there's the violence that's across generational, where you are literally descended from people who are enslaved, where you're descended from people who lived in neighborhoods where when they ventured outside of those neighborhoods, the police patrolled the borders. All of that condenses into a kind of brew. And particularly, I would add, like, the time in which I came up, which was the 80s and the early 90s, when crime was really, skyrocketing. There were all these fears of, guns, crack, cocaine, HIV, just a melange of fear, as you said. I think, you have it exactly right. The stereotype of the African-American community, of African-American people, is one of rage and white people being afraid of black people. And there's not enough conversation of how afraid black people are for themselves, for their bodies, and for their children.
And it relates to your central idea that white America, white supremacy, is about white people's control over black bodies. And a lot of white listeners will think that, I don't care about controlling anybody's black body. So why frame your book so much as about the body rather than voting rights or housing discrimination, like your big essay in The Atlantic last year about reparations was so much about housing discrimination and policy level outcomes of structural racism like those?
Well, the first thing I would say is what any one individual personally cares about is irrelevant. We live in a democracy. What you're talking about is what a plurality, a critical mass of individuals have made their concern. And, just going back to that essay I wrote in The Atlantic, housing discrimination. Housing discrimination was effected through the machinery of democracy. It was done through, presidents, through legislatures. It was not done by a military junta. It was not installed. And while something like housing discrimination sounds like sort of vague, like an abstract, so it ultimately is about the control of the body. It's about the ability of black folks to move where they want. It's about the ability of black parents to secure better neighborhoods where their children are safer from bodily violence. All these sort of abstract things that we think about in policy terms ultimately come back to the physical safety of black people. And, regrettably, as Americans, we're all indicted in that because we live in a democracy. And when we talk about these sorts of policies, again, they are passed through the machinery of democracy. So the fact that any one individual can say, well, I don't care much, about controlling black bodies. Well, it's a fact that when we try to, do fair housing laws and get, black families, moved into certain places, people protest. I mean, this is part of our history. It's a real thing.
Ta-Nehisi Coates with us talking about his important new book, Between the World and Me. The word dreamers has been in our national conversation in recent years, referring to kids who were brought to this country by their undocumented parents. But you use dreamers in this book to refer to a very different group of Americans. Can you talk about who the dreamers are in your writing and their place in society?
Well, not to be circular, but the dreamers are the people who believe in a dream. And the dream that I refer to in the book is the belief that everything you have, all of your personal assets, all of your rights that you enjoy, all the property that you're allowed to accumulate, that all of that has happened here in this country through no detriment to anyone else. It's not actually built on anything else. And that when you drive through, certain neighborhoods, when you drive through East New York, here in this city, when you drive through West Baltimore in the city where I was born, when you drive through Inglewood in Chicago, when you observe certain conditions, that they have no connection at all to the wealth and the plethora of rights that you enjoy here in America. And what I've found in my work, which I sought to reflect in this book, is in fact that that's actually false. The suburbs did not spring up from nowhere, that America's wealth did not just appear out of nowhere, that, you know, behind that is you know, a plethora of broken bodies and blood. And so I really tried to viscerally, you know, bring that across.
David Brooks' column this weekend was about that point in your book, and it was in the form of a letter to you, as you know, Dear Ta-Nehisi Coates.
I think I'll write him back.
No, you can write him back right here. You can dictate. We'll do speech to text. And he credits your book with being an important contribution to the education about race that white people have been getting in this year since Eric Garner and Michael Brown were killed by the police. But then he disagrees with you on this question of the American dream. And he writes, and I'm going to condense a little bit of this, but he says, I think you distort American history. In your anger at the tone of innocence some people adopt to describe the American dream, you reject the dream itself as flimflam, but a dream sullied is not a lie. The dream is a secular faith that has unleashed ennobling energies and mobilized heroic social reform movements. By dissolving the dream under the acid of an excessive realism, you trap generations in the past and destroy the guiding star that points to a better future. So, dear David Brooks, what?
Well, I don't dismiss it as flimflam. I mean, it's very, very real. And he's right, it has done that. I mean, I have no, you know, sort of to quarrel with, you know, all the positive things that have come out. My point is the fact of what it's rooted in, the fact of what makes it, you know, very, very possible even still today. I mean, one, you know, I'm beginning to sound like a broken record going through this history over and over again. But the fact of the matter is you can't imagine this country without, you know, two great crimes, the taking of land from one group of people and the importation of another group of people to work that land. I mean, it's just, you know, you can't imagine all of our freedoms without that. You can't imagine our suburbs without the redlining and the legislation that made, you know, that possible. Our modern social safety net was passed on racist terms. We know this. I mean, this is actual history. Our New Deal legislation would not have been made possible. So the great many things that we think about.
What's that one? Because people might think of the safety net in the opposite terms, that they if black people are more likely to be in the lower socioeconomic groups, that the safety net would benefit them. It's often attacked for, I think, racial terms, racial reasons these days, racial politics.
Right. Well, that's an interesting flip that's happened only in recent years. But if you go back to like the foundation of our New Deal legislation, the origins of our safety net, Social Security, for instance, was written in such a way that for the first 5 years, the majority of African Americans in this country were ineligible. If you look at the GI Bill, which people hail as this, you know, great, you know, bipartisan too, hail as this great, you know, progressive achievement. It was written in such a way to exclude black GIs. The FHA loans that were made available that birthed our suburbs were written in such a way to exclude black people. And so, you know, a great deal of the things that David would talk about in that book, many of the things that we think of as achievements were not possible without the exclusion of black people. And I just think people should acknowledge that. And then you get something more than a dream. You get something actual and real.
Do you worry at all that you're cultivating hopelessness and fatalism in your son, since this is letters to your son, in a way that will limit his horizons?
No, well, I would say two things. First of all, you know, I'm a writer. It is not my job to cultivate either hope or despair.
It's your job as a father, right?
I don't know. I think my primary job is to be honest, you know, to be really, really, really honest and to prepare that boy to go out in the world and be armed to defend himself. That's how I think about it. Now, hope, you know, despair, whatever, might play into that at different points, but I don't think of it as my primary job to make him hopeful. You know, and I say this in the book, my primary job is, you know, my dream for him, if there was a dream, was that he get up every day and that he struggle. That he struggle whether he's going to be successful in his ultimate goals, whether he's going to see those realized within his lifetime or not. And I think that's really, really important. The thing I always say is in this country, there were 250 years of African Americans who were enslaved. That means that there were people for generations who woke up every day, knew enslavement was wrong, struggled against it, and did not live to see the end of it. They struggled. And so, you know, I think that, you know, my son, you know, and I think people in general, you know, have a responsibility to struggle whether or not, you know, there seems to be hope of seeing a solution within their lifetime.
Ta-Nehisi Coates with us. His new book is called Between the World and Me. And Jerry in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jerry.
Hi, yes. First, I thank you, Brian Lehrer. I love your show. And Mr. Ta-Nehisi Coates, I thank you for your book because, you know, it's necessary for our generation. I'm 38 years old, and I have a seven and a half year old son and a 3.5 year old son as well. And I ran and bought this book last week on Friday because it's necessary because my perspective, I'm Haitian, I'm black Haitian, born and raised in Canada. I have that perspective of living now in the United States. And my history is that I have experienced racism in Canada. And, you know, short story, my cousins from Brooklyn came to visit me one day in Canada, and they wanted to learn French words. And I gave them some French words, not so nice ones. And there was a group of skinheads in the park. And, of course, they provoked them, of course, but they chased us, and I've never felt afraid for my life. You know, they were just saying funny French words to them, but we were chased, and I felt like, oh my God, what is going on to me? My father instilled in me my Haitian culture, and knowing that you know that being the first black country to be freed and so forth. But your book is necessary, not to deviate, but your book is necessary because, you know, I'm gonna come out after reading it, understanding the struggle, and reading it to my son. I want him to understand the struggle. It's like a marathon. It's not gonna be easy. You're gonna get to the final, to the end of the race. Just know that it's not going to be easy, but it's up to you to make it harder or to make it easier or to make it to alleviate your pain that you're going to get through going through that race. And that's the way I think I'm going to come out reading your book because it's so important. I mean, it's not about feeling hate, but it's about understanding the truth. This is our reality. And if I were Caucasian or whatever race I am, reading this book, it's not to point the fingers, but just let's all be honest here. This is our reality, and I think that you've voiced it and written it so well, and I thank you so much.
Thank you. I think there's just something really educational in that, in what she was saying, and that is that struggle is not easy. You know, this question again, and I get it all the time. Well, aren't you encouraging despair? You know, aren't you encouraging? The quickest way to encourage despair is false hope. The notion that, you know, if you just do A, B, and C, everything will be alleviated. I think it's much easier to be hopeful once you have a realistic sense of what you're actually up against. And I don't want people to think this is easy. I mean, we are up against the juggernaut of history. You're talking about if it took, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 generations to, you know, get us in this hole, expect, you know, somewhere around double that for us to get us out. And the work should still be done, even knowing that.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Some response coming in on Twitter. You talked about blacks and Social Security, and somebody writes, until very recently, the average age at death for an African-American male was 64. What happened to their FICA withholdings? Interesting point. And someone else writes, Ta, people call you Ta?
I guess.
Ta,
I'll take it.
Please remember to note white folks' passive complicity and the absolute irony of white fear. I think we talked about the irony of white fear. Mm-hmm. How about passive complicity?
Well, I mean, the passive complicity is, well, I individually haven't done anything, you know? But you're an American. You're part of this. You know what I mean? And you are not just an American. You know, I say this all the time. We're very, very happy to, you know, claim credit, you know, for being an American across generations. You know, on July 4th, we all want to celebrate. Everybody's proud of George Washington. Everybody goes down to the National Mall and feels really good about themselves. You don't just get the good side of history. You get the responsibilities of history, too. You don't just get the credits. You get the debits also. That's part of our heritage. And, you know, frankly, I mean, we're using this word white. But, you know, I'm an American, too. You know, my son has, you know, certain privileges that I would say the average African-American growing up in this, you know, in this country does not have. That charges me with certain responsibilities to do things, too. It's not like I get to just, you know, sort of sit back.
So you frame this as partly a challenge to white liberals, I think it's fair to say. Are there main things that you think whites who consider themselves liberal on race don't get or need to actually do?
That's tough because I didn't write the book in that way. I wrote, you know, to be honest with you, I wrote the book because there are things that I hear as an African-American in the conversation with other African-Americans that I wanted to give voice to. My hope was that there would be black folks, you know, across the country, maybe across the world, who would pick this book up, read it, and say, yes, I felt that, and I'm not crazy. It was more as an act of confirmation or validation for how, you know, African Americans see their country. I can't really dictate what white liberals should get from it. It's all hard for me. I hope they get something from it.
Josh in Oyster Bay, you're on WNYC with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Hi.
Good morning, guys. Good morning, Mr. Coates. Good morning, Brian. Just wanted to give a call because I don't know if this sounds kind of like a hot-button issue or not, kind of in the history of the United States, but with regard to the international socialism that was, you'd say, kind of going in full swing until the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, I'm not defending that system whatsoever, but I see maybe as an upside the idea that in the idea of the international socialist system, the Soviets, the Eastern Europeans, developing countries in Africa, Latin America, and Asia were all...
Just to rush you to the point a little bit, is your point that maybe, according to you, socialist economics, a contemporary socialism, would be part of the solution here?
Possibly the best aspects, not the authoritarian or police state aspects, the best aspects of it, that maybe there should be kind of a resurrection over time of the best ideas of socialism to help in all the injustices that have been...
Well, I know at least from reading the book that part of your point is you can't do class economics without making it also explicitly racial economics.
I would probably say anti-racist economics.
Yeah.
As to the point of what there is, you know, to learn, you know, from the Soviet experience, I'm probably unqualified to answer that.
How about to bring it more to a present example? In the Democratic presidential race, such as it is, Bernie Sanders, with his progressive socialism to the left of Hillary Clinton, has almost no black support in the polls compared to her.
Mm-hmm.
Any thought about that?
Is it just lack
of name recognition?
No, I think that's pretty much unsurprising. Hillary Clinton is the wife of Bill Clinton. It's worth remembering that, you know, before Iowa, Hillary Clinton was also leading Barack Obama among, you know, black voters. She has deep roots and, you know, deep connections in the African-American community. No, I'm not particularly surprised by that.
Before we go to some more callers, the book title, Between the World and Me, is reference to something from the writer Richard Wright.
Yes.
What was his Between the World and Me?
Richard Wright's Between the World and Me was a poem, a powerful, powerful poem that I read at a very, very young age that narrates the experience of a man who's walking through the woods, comes across the charred, you know, bones of a lynching victim. And in standing in that moment and feeling himself distant, he actually comes to embody the lynching victim and relives the entire experience. It's a, you know, a work of horror almost. But there's a deep point, I think, in the piece, besides how beautifully it's written, and that is that the voice of the poem comes across this body and sees himself as distant from the past, sees himself as distant from an event that happens, and through the course of the events of the poem, he actually sees that he's very much just as caught up as the body that he stumbled over.
I didn't get this from the book. I don't think you wrote it in the book, but from the New York Magazine article about the book, that you said you've been radicalized since 2008?
Yeah. Well, two things happened. I think having Barack Obama as president gave a focal point to a lot of things. For instance, if you don't have an African-American as president, you don't get the spectacle of just the other day the president going to Oklahoma and being greeted by Confederate flags. Things like that just sort of drew out, you know, I think some stuff that was hidden deeply below the surface, but probably, you know, more significant to me is this coincided with a period where I came to the Atlantic and my employer gave me great room to read and to explore, you know, the kind of room that I had not had since I was in college. And when I came to, you know, the Atlantic in 08 and when, you know, president first came in, I probably was a fairly doctrinaire liberal, you know, believing in, you know, straight class-based solutions, not really, you know, thinking that, you know, you needed to think about race in these sort of specific ways. But after going through, you know, certain readings, particularly Edmund Morgan's American Slavery, American Freedom, like I got the sense of how deeply enslavement was embedded into this country and how far gone the effort was to sort of ignore that and to ignore the legacy of it. That was radicalizing.
John in the Bay Area of California. You're on WNYC. Hello.
So, and I appreciate the conversation. And I'm just comment about what the guests were saying. I think it's a tragedy if you don't enlighten a young black man from the making him aware of the obstacles that he's going to face in America. He's going to be devastated. You're talking to a man that served almost 30 years in prison from the 80s and up until now due to the prison proliferation. And they would rewrite the Constitution. If that many young white men were processed through the system, they would shut the whole system down. Probably in the numbers of millions, you know. Michelle Alexander did a good job getting the statistics in order. But every process that you go through in America is systematically directed young black men and black people in general into the negative context. Every hero or every person, superhero or whatever, needs an opponent. And the black man has been the opponent of America from the start, because you've got to paint somebody as the villain. The United States has been floundering ever since the Soviet Union dismantled, because they haven't had a specific enemy to define, so they've been floundering all over the place.
John, I'm gonna leave it there. Anything you want to say in response to any of that? It's the second time the Soviet Union came up.
I don't know what's going on. The Soviet Union is not in the book.
But right? he's talking about the U.S. being the sole superpower.
Right. I actually think it was a lot that I agreed in. I mean, I think, you know, where he started, the idea that if you don't arm folks with an understanding of what they're going to face, you know, they will be devastated. You know, they will be devastated, I think. And that was, you know, my main motive in writing the book.
Edson in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Edson.
Hey, hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. This is my second time calling you. I agree with the writer. You know, when I was living in Brazil, I never really realized how slavery had a big impact in the country. And, you know, when I went to school over there, the school over there put it down, you know, slavery in Brazil. And when I got over here in America, living over here in New York for the past 25 years, I learned so much about racism and about race in Brazil that is mind-boggling. And in Brazil, we don't like to talk about race. And over here in America, it's the opposite. We everything, you know, circles around race over
here.
So
do you think one is better than the other in pursuit of racial justice and equality?
You know, I think that we have to talk about race. You know, it's one of the variables that you cannot take away. And especially like in Brazil, that took over 4 million people, African, to work over there in the plantation and mines in Brazil. And then you don't want to, you know, study that. Yes. and you don't want to acknowledge that.
Right.
There is a huge impact over there.
Edson, I'm gonna leave it there. I think President Obama said in his eulogy of Reverend Pinckney, we talk about race constantly in
right.
this country. And yet there's this, you know, idea out there, oh, we need to have a national conversation about race, and everybody's afraid to talk about race.
Yeah.
Where do you think we are?
Yeah, I've not been a big proponent of national conversation in the way that it's just depicted, because it's often so vague. But I think the caller actually made a deep point, and this connects back to like the question you were asking about radicalization. Most people in America know that there was slavery, obviously, and they know that and they think that was a bad thing. What I don't think people understand is that there is no America without it. I mean, like you can't imagine American wealth without the 4 million, you know, black folks who were here in 1860 in the South, you know, who were there to work the land. You're talking about the majority of the population of Mississippi, the majority of the population of South Carolina, the collective wealth of African American bodies in this country being more than all of the assets in America put together at the onset of the Civil War. That you can't imagine the New Deal. The New Deal would not have been possible without cutting black people out, and thus the emergence of all of these suburbs that we see, the very land landscape of America, you know, was made possible by cutting black folks out. And see, that's different. That's different than saying racism is a thing that we just sort of have with us. You start to see it as part of the making us possible, part of the birthing of a lot of the things that we like about America. That presents a much, much more complicated problem.
So are you after a deeper understanding of history, primarily, because you don't go, like you didn't in Case for Reparations either, really go to specific policy suggestions for the future, right?
Right, right. I mean, I think reparations is a great policy. You know, yeah, as a general, I understand what you're saying.
You're
no, not, right.
You didn't say go right, hand right, out right, 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 cash like, to
should
everybody.
Should we give out checks?
Or,
should we do this? Yeah, yeah. You know, I think like as a writer, and especially as a writer right now, you know, my primary role is someone who offers diagnosis. And I think that's valuable. It's valuable to know that you have Alzheimer's. It's a good thing, even if we don't know how to cure Alzheimer's yet. It's better than walking around and pretending that, you know, you don't have Alzheimer's. Somebody has to go out and say, listen, we have to at least figure out what the problem actually is and articulate it in as clearest terms possible. You know, the road to solutions, you know, I can't sit here and say, like, I know everything. I have the, you know, the key, you know, to dealing with this long legacy of white supremacy and anti-black racism. But the struggle to see it clearly is important in and of itself. You know, and I'll defend it. You can't get to the key. You can't get to a solution if you can't see it clearly.
Question via Twitter. Has Mr. Coates' son read the book?
Yes, yeah, several times. He read it in several iterations. He read it in draft when it was, you know, printed off of my computer at home. He read it in galley, and he has read the book.
And?
He likes it. He likes it. I mean, I asked the permission to write it in the way that it's written, and I would not have put it out there without his approval at all.
You didn't like President Obama seeming to preach personal responsibility to black Americans on the occasions when he's done that. Mm-hmm. Do you think it has no place? I mean, the president sometimes puts that in the context of fatherhood. Were you at the Democratic Convention in 08?
Yes, I was.
I don't know if you heard it the way I did. When he came up with that line about fathers being involved with their kids, right. It was maybe the biggest cheer he got at the big stadium in Denver there, and a very, you know, mixed racial crowd.
Right.
How do you, as a black father who seems so involved with your son, feel when you see what might be described as rampant fatherlessness and its effects?
Well, I mean, my book, which, you know, did not generate all of this publicity in 2008, was, you know, the subtitle was A Father, Two Sons, you know, Struggle for Manhood or something. I think I'm mangling the subtitle, but that was basically it. So I think fatherhood is very, very important. You know, I think personal responsibility is very, very important. I talk to it about, you know, with my son. I don't know a single parent who would not talk about it with their children. But the idea that personal responsibility, that individual virtue, is enough, you know, to defeat white supremacy. And I would argue is even, you know, an essential component. Because I think most people, you know, on balance do have individual virtue. Most people on balance do have personal responsibility. I can't see the black community as less virtuous, less responsible. But it's not, you know, I just don't think it's a panacea or a solution to these, you know, big sort of statewide social problems.
We have a minute left. I read you're moving to France for a year. True?
Yes, that's true.
Because?
I wanted my son to be exposed to other things. That's always been a goal of me and my wife's, for him to, you know, see other things.
Is it other things in general, sort of see the world, or how much, considering what you write about, is it for your son to have the experience of being, quote, black over there as opposed to over here?
No, I mean, I think we got the black part down pretty well. I when I was his age, I did not have a very, you know, internationalist or cosmopolitan perspective. In fact, I probably didn't get that until I was in my 30s. I don't want him to have to wait that long to be able to see things that way.
You answered so fast that I'm going to throw in another one. your reaction to Charleston and that display of forgiveness, maybe compared to Baltimore,
right,
where after Freddie Gray, you know, uprising or riot, choose your word?
Well, I think they're different facets of humanity. You know, sometimes things happen and we get really, really angry. Sometimes things happen and we realize the only way forward is forgiveness. Less, you know, the hatred poison our soul. As somebody that grew up outside of the church, I probably have a little bit of difficulty relating to what I saw, but that has nothing to do with its legitimacy and, you know, the right of people to mourn as they see fit.
Any appearances that you have coming up where people can meet
not
you?
Not till October.
Oh, not till October. Okay. Well, we'll have to have you back on the show in October, and we'll promote some of your in-person stuff.
Okay.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, his new book is called Between the World and Me. Thank you for talking about it with
Thank
us.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you so much.
It's the Best of Brian Lehrer Show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Joyce Mitchell, the female staffer who allegedly assisted the two inmates who escaped from the Clinton Correctional Facility, admitted to engaging in a sexual relationship with one of the prisoners. Such interactions between prison workers and inmates may happen more than we think. In fact, they're quite common, according to my next guest, even though sexual misconduct in jail is a punishable crime in all 50 states. Brenda Smith has published several studies about prison life, including Rethinking Prison Sex, Self-Expression, and Safety. She's a professor at the Washington College of Law at American University and the project director for the United States Department of Justice National Institute of Corrections Cooperative Agreement on Addressing Prison Rape. Brenda Smith, welcome to WNYC. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
We saw an ABC News story that you were featured in that revealed that according to government reports, more than half of all sexual misconduct cases in prison are committed by female workers. How common are sexual encounters between inmates and female prison staff?
You know what? I think they are very, very common. And what I think is pretty interesting is that sort of goes against, sort of common wisdom. Actually, about 70% of staff sexual misconduct, both in prison and jails, is committed by female staff members. And when you look at juvenile facilities, the numbers are even more astonishing, where the numbers are somewhere between 90 and 95%.
What do you mean juvenile facilities? Teenage boys?
Yes.
Incarcerated with adult female guards?
Well, yes. What we're talking about is when I talk about juvenile facilities, I'm talking about facilities that hold youth who have not been committed of sort of adult crimes, but I'm talking about juvenile facilities where someone would go for getting into a fight at school, for, you know, stealing a car, and who is being prosecuted as a youth and not as an adult.
There was even the case that we learned about in the Baltimore City Detention Center where a gang leader, Tavon White, fathered five children with four different female guards while inside the prison. Two of the guards had the inmate's name tattooed on their bodies. How much of an outlier is that?
You know, I'd like to say that it is an outlier. I think that, you know, Baltimore is sort of its own thing, but I would not be surprised to find similar conduct in other facilities. I think that what you had in Baltimore is you had a federal wiretapping project going on, and so you got a lot more information. I would not be surprised if similar conduct is going on in New York prisons and jails and in other facilities around the country.
Where do these sexual encounters typically happen in a prison? How are these encounters possible, if the inmates are in cells and privacy is rare?
Well, you know, the reality is that, you know, these are large facilities. They're complex. Most facilities do not have the kinds of cameras or supervision that they need to have, nor do they have the kind of staff. But in terms of what we know from the data, you know, and there's great data from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, these sexual interactions happen everywhere. They often happen in closets, right, where, you know, you keep mops, brooms. They happen in kitchens. And, in fact, there are meetings every year, the people who provide food in prisons and jails, and where there's specifically conversation and panels that are happening about sex with people who work in kitchens, because often inmates work there. They often happen on work details, where inmates are circulating around with staff in the evening time, cleaning the facility. So anywhere where there's an opportunity for a staff member to be alone with an inmate, they can happen. In some litigation that I was involved in, there were very clear places where the sex happened in every facility. In one place, it was an education trailer. In another, it was the chapel. And in another, it was on the loading dock.
Let me ask you about these two pieces of your work that I introduced you with. So there's that one, working for the U.S. Justice Department on addressing prison rape. The other, the study, Rethinking Prison Sex, Self-Expression, and Safety. So self-expression, do you argue that allowing inmates routinely some sexual outlet is a good thing for everybody?
Yes.
Make the case.
Okay, so make the case. First of all, I want to clarify two things. I want to make sure that it's very clear that my comments do not represent the Department of Justice's view on things. These are my comments. I have been funded to do a variety of work for the Department of Justice, including training correctional staff and producing material specifically related to this issue. And at some point, I can give the website and we can talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the earlier article that you referenced, one of the first that I wrote on this issue, my position is that everybody has a desire to have some ability to express themselves sexually. And I think that what happens is when people go into prisons and jails, we assume that there will not be sexual activity, or at least that's what we legislate. And the fact is that that sexual activity in prison occurs, whether inmates self-stimulate, whether they have sex with other inmates, or whether, as the case that we're talking about here, they have sex with staff. And my view is if there are legitimate ways for people to have that contact, then what you can do is you can cut down on some of the prohibited contact and also the ability of staff and other inmates to use sex as a way to either barter or take advantage of people or either to terrorize them.
And also, if they have this outlet, they're less likely to be violent and in, you know, ways that because they have an outlet for their sexual energy, then they may not get, you know, their overall energy so pent up that they're likely to be more troublesome inmates. Is that a part of it?
You know what? I can't make any claim about knowing about the sort of connection between being more sexually active and being less aggressive. I think that there are people who would make that claim. I'm certainly not.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I would say is I think that the fact that inmates don't have that ability creates a real environment where they can be taken advantage of. I also think that you know, we've talked about the ability to have sexual relations. I think that there are other things that also create the conditions where sex becomes a bargaining chip for things. So, for example, if inmates don't have an opportunity to make money, so, for example, they can make phone calls, or if they don't have the opportunity to make money so that they can buy food or buy clothing or buy a radio or whatever, it really puts them in a position where where sex becomes a bargaining chip, and not only sex, but also other kind of bad behavior, right? So if there's somebody who has access to those kinds of things, then what can happen is they can pressure or coerce or persuade another inmate who has an in, for example, with a staff member to do things.
Craig in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Craig.
Hey, good morning, Brian, to you and your guests. I was incarcerated in Pennsylvania facility, even though I was in New York. You know, I took my show on the road. And I worked in a kitchen detail. And, you know, when you're in the kitchen, they have private workers in that's, you know, that's like not correction officers, but they're, you know, staff that work the kitchen and you work closely with them.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, one or two of the female staff not got caught, but were in relationship with the male kitchen staff. And because it's a massive kitchen and, you know, when it's time to put out trash and do other things, you know, and it's the oven might be this way, but the sink might be this way. And, you know, people get lost, you know, when there's one or two people working and people sneak off and do, you know, but inmates, like, you know, anybody always talk, you know, when somebody takes their call or give them a number or money order, and you know that's how it happens. And one lady even got fired because she was messing with a guy, I don't think having relationships, but soon as the guy got out, you know, it was rumored that they were close. And when he got paroled, she said, oh, my boo is home. And she posted him on the Facebook page. And the other coworkers seen it and immediately reported. And I think, like, Pennsylvania law is like 2 years before you can even have some kind of contact with somebody that's recently released.
So did you ever see sex in the prison used as a bargaining chip for anything in the way that our guest was just describing?
Not so much as I could say. I see a lot of ladies that's like get so much attention from men, and these are not, you know, not being crude or rude, but these are not, some of them not the best, you know, ladies probably on the street, these men probably wouldn't even talk to them, but some of them may have some kind of self-esteem issue, and the guys every day just saying, hey, how nice they look and this, and I don't know, you know. You know, that's something I feel right. But I wanted to ask your guest about Bedford, New York. It was a couple of years ago when there was a big scandal about a lot of the inmates not getting visits, but the female inmates were getting pregnant. And it was a big thing about that up there. And did she ever hear about it? And what was the result? Because they at one time they were giving the women abortions. And these were women that weren't getting visits or anything. So they knew that however they were getting pregnant have to be associated with the staff.
Are you familiar with the case?
Yeah, I am. So I want to go back and talk about a couple of things that Craig said.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that he talks about is he talks about kitchen staff, right? And he makes a great point, which is that we're talking not only about Department of Corrections personnel, but we're also talking about contractors who can come in from a variety of places. They can be priests, they can be teachers, they can be kitchen workers, I mean, they can be people who are running programs, they can be lawyers. All of those people have been found to be involved in these sexual relations with inmates, right? The second thing that I want to talk about is what are you talking about in terms of these women getting lots of attention that they would not necessarily get out on the street from these guys? I think that that's a fair comment to make, but I also think that one of the things that we know in the data is that often these relationships can start off like that, right? But then they can go bad, and so they can go from willing to unwilling, right? And I think that's something that we need to talk about. The last comment, which was really about the situation involving sexual abuse of women in custody at Bedford Hills. As I said at the beginning, this issue was initially thought to be primarily an issue involving female staff, and often it came to the attention of authorities because of pregnancies of women in custody, right? And that has been an issue actually since the beginning of prisons. In fact, I think I've talked about before that actually you ended up with separate women's prisons because of a female inmate back in the 1800s, Rachel Welch, who was 5 months pregnant, became pregnant while she was in custody and was beaten to death by a male guard, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it continues to be an issue, and though we're talking about sexual abuse involving female staff and male inmates, the issue of sexual abuse of all inmates continues to be a huge problem.
And Craig, thank you very much for your call. So he was talking about the relationship that had developed in this one particular case between a female prison guard who he didn't think was having sexual relationships with the inmate, with a particular inmate. But then when the inmate got out, there was, you know, she referred to it on her Facebook page and got in trouble for that. So here's Governor Cuomo discussing this dynamic in a press conference after investigators learned that the Dannemora prison worker, Joyce Mitchell, helped two prisoners escape.
I understand prisons run on a delicate balance, and having a good relationship between guards and the inmates is important. But there's a line, and when the line is stepped over, then action has to be taken.
Yeah, I think smuggling power tools to the inmate might be a line that's crossed, you think?
I think so. I, think so. And, Brian, one of the things that I think is really interesting, I'm glad you mentioned that sort of smuggling the power tools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sex that we're talking about does not happen in a vacuum. In some ways, I feel like it's the least of the issues, because what we're really talking about is we're talking about a place where there's very lax security, right? And that's number one. These are supposed to be secure facilities. And
by definition, maximum security facility at Dannemora.
Exactly. And so certainly one of the things that many, many correctional agencies have seen is that you actually have to perform, you have to have security that not only targets people in custody, you know, you actually have to have security that targets staff as well. Because whether or not, as in this case, staff bring things in willingly, or either willingly or intentionally, or whether they unintentionally bring something in and a person in custody can have access to it, you know, it's very important, because security is number one. And I think what you're seeing, what you saw up in Dannemora, was just a total breakdown in security.
John in California, you're on WNYC. Where in California, John?
Los Angeles.
Thanks for calling in.
But and I respect the words of the previous speaker, but you're actually talking to someone who's actually served time in the California prison system. And the California, the prison system is a kind of world within itself. And the actual inmate is much more of a victim than it's being portrayed. You know, the free person or the officer or the staff have all the power. And I correlated to going back to as far as, like I mentioned earlier, the plantation owner and the slave. You know, the plantation owner has all the power, just like the officer has all the power. He or she decides when they're going to make an appearance in front of the prisoner, and when what they're going to allow to take place, how fast the process is going to move forward with a relationship or interaction or whatever. And one person has all of the power. That's why in California it's actual crime. It ain't no such thing as consensual sex or relationship, because one person has all the power and then one person has no power at all. And it just they're not, so a person isn't pressured or threatened into bringing any contraband in. It's done almost willingly. It's probably with a little extra persuasion or a little sweet talking.
John, when you were in, were you aware of any sexual relationships between male inmates and female guards?
It's not as rampant as salacious as you might think on TV, but it's always happened because it's a human business and emotions tend to get involved.
Right.
But that's why they have a policy. They don't let one person stay in one location as far as jobs no more than 2 years, because over a period of time, a person tends to become emotionally connected. And then when emotions get involved, the security becomes an issue. You know, judgment, you know, good judgment diminishes. So,
yes.
So it's but what happens a lot, and we saw it in the New York situation, is a lot of women, probably, you know, and even men, because they got women's prisons also, are emotionally starved and, you know, in the free world. So they come into an atmosphere that's highly concentrated and emotionally, and prison is an emotion-free zone for prisoners. Prisoners aren't allowed to grieve if a loved one passed. They aren't allowed to be extremely happy if some good news comes, because people see that as an opportunity to pick up beef with. You know, if a guy is too happy, somebody's going to challenge him about it. Or
John, I'm going to leave it there, but a lot of stuff for us to chew on. Thank you. I really appreciate
you
calling.
Thank
you very much. Yeah. And people probably wonder, you know, why would a female prison guard who is out in the world and presumably could have relationships with people who aren't criminals or aren't locked up, have sexual relationships with a criminal in the first place, with an inmate in the first place? And he gave two reasons there. One is that just relationships develop. They become humanized to each other. That's why they rotate guards out of particular assignments after a while, right? So a sympathy, a relationship of any kind doesn't develop that might be to the detriment of security. And the other one, that the female guards who might be more likely to engage would be ones who don't have anything going on in the outside world. Does that all make sense to you?
You know what? I think it makes sense, but I want to go back to something. I mean, first of all, John made great comments. And as he said, you know, sex between people in custody is prohibited in every state. So that's that is the floor. But I think, Brian, one of the things that you said that I think we need to unpack a little bit, and one is, like, why would anybody want to have sex with a criminal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that, you know, the people who are in custody are people mm-hmm. who committed a crime, as opposed to being sort of their whole identity being the crime that they committed. In, you know, right now we've got over 2 million people in custody. And it used to be that nobody knew anybody who was in custody. And I think that if your sort of audience thought about it, everybody knows somebody who's in custody now.
Right.
Somebody's kid who made a bad mistake or
right.
whatever. And they aren't going to identify that person as necessarily a criminal. So what you're doing is you have people who are human, who have interests, who are intelligent, who are smart, who are talented, actually like Mr. Madden and Mr. Sweat, who are involved in this incident. Incredibly talented people may also be very well spoken. And so the reality is that relationships can develop, admiration can develop, but what is so, so important, as the last speaker talked about, is having in place policies, procedures, training, right, for staff to understand that it's okay to be supportive, it's okay to be engaging and engaged, but at the end of the day, it's about the safety and security of the facility and also about the appropriate boundaries between them and staff.
Before,
and I think that gets lost.
Before you go, ABC News reported that between 2001 and 2007, the number of female correctional officers in male facilities increased from 24% of staff to 40% of staff.
Right.
Why was that sharp increase taking place?
Well, you know, I also want to bring it home to New York. In New York, there was an article maybe about 4 or 5 years ago that said that the majority of correctional staff in Rikers is now female, primarily African American. Right? And I think that what has happened with the rise of women in custody are a couple of things. More men who would be doing these jobs actually can't meet the requirements to do them. They may not have the educational requirements. They may not be able to pass a background check in terms of their criminal activity, and they may not be able to pass a drug test.
Yeah, you know, Commissioner Bratton just said recently that's why there aren't as many applicants to be police officers, and the standards for correctional officers are lower. To be police officers, they're having trouble finding enough young African-American men that they, you know, as many as they want to really make their staff more diverse because of those various factors you just mentioned.
And what I'd say, Brian, is it's not just, I mean, it's men in general. Now, let's also talk about the demographics also of custodial settings. So you have young women coming into these institutions. I'd say the last data I saw was that 70% were either never married, divorced, and often had children, right? So we're talking about people who are unpartnered. And, you know, 93% of the criminal justice population is male, and primarily people of color. And so you're talking about people who are supervising people who out in the community they would be engaged in social relationships with. And so that's why it's mm-hmm. even more important to have the kind of supervision and support to sort of understand that those relationships, while there may be some similarities, those are not relationships that can occur in custody.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I really, really appreciate it, and I think for a lot of our listeners who may have heard the Dana Morris story and just thought, what? This prison guard woman had sex with these lifers? What? Now we know a lot more context for that, thanks to you. Brenda Smith has published several studies about prison life, including Rethinking Prison Sex, Self-Expression, and Safety. She's a professor at the Washington College of Law at American University and project director for the United States Department of Justice National Institute of Corrections Cooperative Agreement on Addressing Prison Rape. Thank you again very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, why even a short walk in the park before Labor Day weekend ends can do wonders for your mental health. Stay with us. WNYC, and here's something that you might not have thought needed an academic study, but now it has one. Walking in the park is a good thing, according to a study done by Gregory Bratman, Gretchen Cara Daly, and their team at Stanford University. Walking in the park reduces stress and negative thoughts, and we have Gretchen Cara Daly on the show with us today. Welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hey, thank you, Brian. Hello from Stanford.
So, what was your hypothesis, and how did you test it?
Well, the hypothesis was that being out in nature, if you're normally steeped in a really busy, kind of stressful urban life, would help alleviate that stress, and that that would be reflected in the neural activity in your brain. So we're basically trying to find out what is the mechanism by which being in nature gives us that kind of soothing feeling that we seek there. And can we, if we get this evidence, as you put it, help shine a light on the broader benefits that would come from investing a lot more in access to nature in cities and in our modern lives?
So in the study, you take half the group to tree-lined paths and the other half along the highway. And then what? How did you measure the different responses?
Yeah, so we had these people first come into the lab, and we put them through a little questionnaire, which gives us a sense of how much they tend to ruminate or have these sort of brooding thoughts on all the dumb things we've all done in our lives, these sort of repetitive, negative, you know, criticisms of ourselves. And then we also scanned their brains, tracking blood flow, and blood flow in the brain indicates how much neural activity there is in different areas. Then they got randomly assigned either to walk in a beautiful kind of park-like area near the lab or along, it wasn't a highway, but kind of a, it's this eight-lane, pretty busy road, loud, a lot of traffic. And then we put them through the questionnaire and brain scan again. And that's where we saw a much more dramatic result than I expected, where people, you know, who are out on this busy street basically had no change. You know, they came in a little bit stressed and they left this whole experience a little bit stressed and ruminating. Whereas people who'd been out in nature just for this 90-minute walk, I didn't think that would be enough, given all that we were putting them through with the questionnaire and the brain scan and so on. But it was enough to really lower these sort of self-reported levels of ruminating and kind of negative thought and lower neural activity in this part of the brain that's linked to risk for mental illness, especially kind of anxiety and depression-related disorders.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it certainly makes logical sense, right? If you're walking in a park and spending 45 minutes going, oh, look at that squirrel, as opposed to along the eight-lane road and saying, oh, God, these trucks are so loud, or I hope nobody runs me over.
Right, or what an idiot I am to be here. But, yeah, I guess the thing is we're all here now. It's incredible that over half of humanity is now packed into cities. And the rate of urbanization is incredible around the world. We're expecting about 70% of people to be living in cities by 2050. And with that, you know, is coming a really dramatic decrease in nature exposure, both from, you know, not having access to nature, but also just culturally. We live in such hectic lives, and our employers don't really value our taking time out to soothe our minds and clear our heads and stuff. And we're seeing a big uptick in mental health issues, especially in cities. The risk of anxiety and mood disorders is a lot more pronounced in cities than in, you know, rural areas. So the big thing is, what can we all do about it, and how can we get a lot more access to people deprived of it?
And here's evidence that one thing we can do is so simple. But it's funny, when you talk about this concentration of the human race in cities, that 70% of people will live in urban areas by 2050, it's so different in different countries, right? Like, there's a lot of developing countries where there's this mass migration from rural poverty to urban poverty, and sometimes their lives get worse when they move to these big third world, you know, mega cities that are developing huge shanty towns and everything on the outskirts and even in town. In this country, the elite are choosing to move to cities, right? In the millennial generation, unlike the baby boomers who tended to flee to the suburbs, the people with the most choice tend to want to live in cities today.
Yep. But then when you look at mental illness, you know, it strikes every class of people. And it seems it's crucial that we get a lot more, you know, awareness now of the risks we're putting ourselves to with the lifestyle choices we make. I mean, at least the elites can get out a bit more into nature if they choose. But we're all so wired up these days and getting remoter and remoter from the, you know, the environment we evolved in as a species. And stress is just as higher in among elites and so on. So I see this as one of our biggest challenges, is to understand before it's too late what humanity needs to live fulfilling lives, happy lives, which ultimately is what everybody really seeks. And we're losing nature at a blinding rate in our generation. We're likely to see the loss of over half of the other life forms that we share this part of the universe with, maybe the whole universe. And you were asking in the last segment, who cares about this sort of thing? We've got to mobilize a lot more awareness and concern about all these other
people.
Bits of the machinery of nature, that keep us going, and people.
Gretchen Caradaley, environmental science professor at Stanford, and Russ in Sussex County. You're on WNYC. Hi, Russ.
Good morning, Brian. Yeah, I do 40,000 miles a year traveling around the North Jersey metropolitan area as an entertainer, and I used to have terrible, terrible road rage. But over the last several years, I got this little, very rustic place in the woods up above Binghamton, and I spend a lot of time up there, 3-4 days at a time with no cell service, no electricity, a lot of time to myself and thinking.
Uh-huh.
And you know what? I think that really helped me get over my road rage in some way.
Russ, that's a great story, and it plays right into your study, doesn't it, Professor Daly? If we consider road rage a form of, you know, stress on the mental health, and now he goes more to the woods and he doesn't have the road rage.
Absolutely. And I mean, the beauty of it is first in finding a solution, and like you're saying, it's basically a simple solution. If we see now what we're trying to find is, you know, how much exposure do people need? And fantastic, Russ, that you found a way to get out into the woods for a few days at a time and unplug and stuff. But how about for everybody? What do we really need? And it's nice in this study to find that even a pretty short walk, just in a, you know, the nature area here, it's still in the heart of Silicon Valley, which is pretty heavily urbanized. So something a lot of us could benefit from pretty easily. But how do we make that available to a lot more people? And what are the key ingredients if we're going to design better parks in our cities? What are the key ingredients of nature that will really provide those benefits?
How would you answer that question from what you know? What needs to be, because you're really asking not just parks, but what needs to be in those parks, right?
Yep, that's exactly it. And, I mean, scientifically, we don't yet know. My guess, having spent a lot of time both in urban areas and in nature, is that the sounds are really important. A lack of, you know, traffic noise might be really important. Some bird song or, you know, little crickets and things. Beautiful views, just other kinds of activity to look at, like the squirrel, you know, something else to relate to take our minds off, you know, our self-centered focus and feel connected to the broader, you know, web of life that we're all intimately connected with, but that we can so easily lose sight of. And then some people say, actually, it's breathing in some of the chemicals that plants give off, that those aromas actually are laden with really beneficial chemicals. People are just starting to look into that. And then other people say that there are these sounds out there that we can't even hear with our ears, but that we take in maybe through our chests. It's not clear. This is research going on in Japan. But there are these really high-frequency sounds that are actually in a lot of forests with bird calls and some insect calls and things that make us feel a lot better. And the research shows that some kinds of music, like the music of Bali, for example, incorporates these very high-frequency sounds. And they have tested people before and after listening to this music, mm-hmm. and they feel a lot better. So. Yeah. It'll be a mix of things, but definitely just getting the greenery out there is the really key start.
I feel better just having this conversation, talking about these things. What is your next study? How do you follow up?
Next, this will sound a little weird, but we're actually bringing people into the lab to try to dissect out what are some of the key ingredients. And in the lab, we're showing people different videos of different elements of nature to see what people respond most to. And we're also playing different types of sounds of water flowing and different types of bird calls and things like that as compared to more urban sounds, just to see what really fires us up in a positive way and helps soothe some of the negative that we'd like to let go of more.
And now you have to add a new variable with shoes and without shoes.
Right.
Control group. Gretchen Caradeli, professor of environmental science at Stanford University. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Happy Labor Day, everyone. Enjoy the afternoon. We'll be back live tomorrow.